I mean, there are different explanations why people forgot everything about Ghadir Khum. And especially the question is raised regarding Ansar. There are different explanations. One explanation is that we know that the immigrants should be firstly blamed for what happened in Saqifah Bani Sa'ada. And some people, of course, Ansar should be blamed as well. But the point is that according to some explanations, first of all, Ansar also became president in Saqifah so that at least, some of them, they could defend Imam Ali al-Islam. And when they come to this conclusion that no, I mean, Muhajirin is not going to give the right to Imam Ali al-Islam, then they try to have this rulership and caliphate for themselves. And of course, they were not able to do so, and they were defeated by the immigrants. And the other point is the fact that this allegiance was taken by force. The Sunni historical books talk about a very famous tribe. The name is mentioned in the books, which on that very day, on those days, special days, they were, they were asked by the first caliph and other people who supported them to force people to pay allegiance to Abu Bakr. So maybe we can claim that most of the people who paid allegiance to the first caliph, it was not through their own will and wish. They were forced to act upon that. And the other point that we need to take into consideration is the tribal issues.
Yes.
Although these people have heard all these instructions from the Prophet, but at the end of the day, people are still thinking of the benefits and the privileges of their tribes. And although the Holy Prophet tried his best, but still people, and up until today, we see that in some parts of the world, people are thinking about tribal relations. So at the end of the day, many of them prefer these relations over the rights of Imam Ali al-Islam.
Do we have any sentence from Lady Fatima al-Zahra proving the imamate of Imam Ali al-Islam as an authentic source, you know, as the daughter of Prophet Muhammad?
Thank you for raising this significant question, because we have the same question regarding Lady Zahra Salamuna Aliha. I think the Sermon of Fadak is enough for answering this question. Very explicitly, Lady Zahra Salamuna Aliha is talking about this issue. But not only that, we know that based on, again, both Shia and Sunni sources, Imam Ali alayhi salam, together with Lady Zahra Salamuna Aliha, they went to the houses of the companions of the Prophet, especially the Ansar, the helpers, and to tell them, to remind them of what happened in Ghadir Khum and in other occasions, to tell them that, you know, that Imam alayhi salam is the true successor of the Prophet, why you have chosen Abu Bakr as the first caliph. For example, this had been mentioned in Al-Imama wa Siyasa by Ibn Qutaybah Dinawari, a Sunni scholar, volume 1, page 19. It's been mentioned that in this part of the book, it's been mentioned that together with Fatima al-Zahra Salamullahi alayha, Imam alayhi salam used to go to the houses of Ansar at nights, and answering Lady Zahra Salamullahi alayha, the Ansar told that we have paid allegiance to Abu Bakr, and had your husband and your son-in-law and your cousin had come to us before him, we would have paid allegiance to him. And so they brought some excuses. Also, Ibn Abi al-Hadith says that Imam Ali alayhi salam, together with Lady Zahra Salamun alayha, used to go to the houses of Ansar and others, other companions of the Prophet. It's been mentioned in the commentary of Nahj al-Balagha, volume 11, page 14, that 40 people accepted the request of Imam Ali al-Salam and Lady Zahra Salamullah alayha and paid allegiance to him, that we are with you even if it is the matter of our life. So Imam Ali al-Salam told them that if this is the case, tomorrow come to me in the early morning while you have shaved your head and you are armed. But the point is that the next day in the morning, only 4 people were present. So the next night, Imam Ali Salam and Lady Zahram Salamullah Alayha did the same. Again, they promised, but they didn't show up. And the third happened, and the same happened for the next night. So in all these cases, we see that both Imam Ali Alayhi Salam, Lady Zahra Salamullah Alayha, and other faithful companions of Imam Ali Salam did so. They refer to different events in which the Holy Prophet introduced Imam Ali Salam as his caliphate. But the point is that those companions did not act upon the instructions of the Holy Prophet. So no one can claim that Imam Ali Salam and Lady Zahra Salamullah Alayha were silent.
Thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fi al-jannati nahran min laban li Aliyin wa Husaynin wa Hasan. Li Aliyin wa Husaynin wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A ribbon-cutting ceremony to go down in history. Opening the production line of Iran's first homegrown jet trainer, Yasin. According to Iran's Defense Minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani, the jet trainer is capable of carrying out combat missions as well as other tactical aerial warfare actions such as close air support or CAS. Air-to-ground actions against hostile targets in close proximity of friendly forces.
Training good pilots is extremely important, and now with this homegrown jet trainer, we have technologically evolved significantly. This is considered a major step for our Air Force. The training period will now be shorter and more comprehensive.
Prior to this, jet pilot training was done outside Iran, and due to Western and U.S. sanctions, Iranian pilots could not receive training abroad.
We did ask for assistance, but no country in world help us. However, at the end of the day, it worked out for the best because we were able to develop the technology that we needed ourselves. Knowledge-based companies help us a lot. In particular, I have to point out the design of the engine and also its aerodynamic design. All in all, Yasin is about 800 kilometers lighter than our first prototype, which is a significant achievement.
Iran started designing jet trainers over 10 years ago. Yasin is the second generation of a prototype that was unveiled in 2019. The new version now includes state-of-the-art avionics, engine, landing gear, and full cockpit devices.
With all the equipment installed, this training jet is fully equipped and it can be used for training pilots in all different levels.
But there's more to Yasin than just training fighter jet pilots.
It is also a question of prestige. This jet trainer was made by our own scientists and inventors. Knowledge-based companies played a very important part. Obviously, it means great economic benefits, but other than that, it shows that we can stand on our own feet. This is the most important message.
In the next 2 years, three more Yassin jet trainers will be produced based on the requirements of Iran's Air Force.
Iran has made great achievements in the field of aviation, and this is a symbol of self-sufficiency of the Islamic Republic. Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
Despite the cold winter day, a huge turnout by thousands of NHS workers and their supporters calling for action in a dispute officially about inflation matching pay, but really so much more than just that.
It's about the fighting for the heart of the NHS, because we feel this government is not committed to the principles of the NHS, which is a free, comprehensive service for all. They are privatising it by stealth, and they're hoping that it fails so that they then can do even more privatisation.
There are concerns about public safety when there are fewer workers available on strike days in a health service already at breaking point, which speaks of a deeper crisis.
Been depleted of funds, staff are leaving. NHS pay has been cut in real terms. And because of this, we're seeing staffing leaving. There's a staffing crisis. We cannot provide the care we want to give to our patients.
Similar action in recent months by nursing and ambulance unions seems to have forced the government to shift from its position on the amount of pay rises for this year, leading to some health unions to tentatively cancel strikes planned for this month. An 8-month strike wave that began last summer has seen industrial action across the public sector. Despite their impact, public support is still strong, especially for the NHS workers.
Just a regular person that loves the NHS, and I think everyone in the UK loves them, and we don't want to see the NHS in crisis.
Next week we'll see 3 days of strikes by junior doctors who have experienced a real terms pay cut of over 26% as the costs of food, energy and rent soar.
The demonstrators here today say while they share the concern about the impact of strike action on patients, they have to do it to safeguard the health service before it's too late. Saeed Purza, London.
Iran's Shahid Rudaki warship, an unlikely but definitely meaningful location to hold the closing ceremony of the 17th International Resistance Film Festival.
Now, in these days, you know that the films are more important even than the books. So it's very important for us to make people to know about our beliefs, also our artists and our filmmakers.
It helps us to give information through movies to our children about Islam, about Palestine, people, how they suffer. Someone just see a movie and starts crying after seeing what happens in Palestine, in Yemen, in Syria, through movies.
In these films, or what we're doing about drama and films, we want to give message. And our message to the Israel, that if you kill our people, we will speak about this.
In my opinion, resistance movies are mostly about war because they show that we have to fight to survive. We have to fight for our rights. And this is the most important message of resistance movies.
Making resistance movies is not just about sending a message, which of course is an important part of the whole issue, but everything about this genre is also a challenge. Consider the special effects, the computer graphics, the stunts, the cinematography in general. This genre turns a filmmaker into an expert.
2 kilometers away off the coast, the offshore closing ceremony on the blue waters of the Persian Gulf awarded the best resistance movies in several sections, including documentaries, animations, and short and feature-length movies. As expected, The Stranger, a movie directed by Mohammad Hossein Latifi that depicts the life of the IRGC commander Mohammad Burujerdi, swept most of the awards, while The Situation of Mahdi and The Mudroom came in next. But the success of an up-and-coming young female director definitely stole the show.
Leyli Aj impressed the jury with her first movie, Colonel Soraya, a must-see, according to movie critics, that depicts the notorious terrorist group MKO.
The festival has been doing very well. So as a filmmaker, I feel proud that veteran filmmakers in the jury have found my film worthy of the Best Picture Award. Now this makes my job more difficult because expectations are high.
The main reason to produce films is to bring impact to people's lives, to bring change in people's lives. As a religious student, one of the best ways to preach is to produce films.
According to Major General Hossein Salomi, the chief commander of the IRGC and the keynote speaker of the closing ceremony, the Resistance Film Festival has been able to do a great job in building cultural and artistic bridges between resistance filmmakers and therefore has become a powerful tool of cultural diplomacy with a promising future.
The 17th International Resistance Film Festival has come to an end in the most memorable way, with its participants hoping that they can use cinema to inspire people across the world and promote resistance against oppression. Gisumish Ahmadi, Asaluye.
Activists gathered in Seoul to protest Japan's plan to begin releasing the radioactive contaminated water accumulating as a result of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. The demonstration comes as the region marks the 12th anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, with several nations, including China, protesting Tokyo's plan.
Japan's neighbors, including China, South Korea, North Korea, and Russia, as well as Pacific Island countries, have repeatedly expressed concerns and firm opposition to Japan's plan to discharge the nuclear-contaminated wastewater into the sea.
On March 11, 2011, a tsunami flooded the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, causing the meltdowns of three reactors. 150,000 people were evacuated. The disaster caused nuclear-reliant countries to rethink energy policies. Under previous President Moon Jae-in, South Korea had been moving to phase out nuclear energy. Now, under President Yoon Suk-yeol, the country has reversed course with plans to increase nuclear energy production to more than 30% of the total by 2030. South Koreans demonstrating in Seoul oppose the country's return to nuclear energy reliance. South Korea is not only renewing old reactors, but restarting construction on new reactors and building nuclear power plants for other countries.
Energy policies centered on nuclear power are being misrepresented as a solution to the safety of the people and the climate crisis. The lifespan of old nuclear power plants across the country, including Busan Gori No. 1, is being extended without regard for safety, and the region is in danger of becoming a nuclear waste site.
South Korea is developing a nuclear waste problem with existing spent fuel storage set to reach full capacity within 10 years. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After a year spent in Ukraine covering the ongoing conflict with Russia, Italian freelance journalists Andrea Ceresini and Alfredo Bosco returned to Italy a couple of weeks ago on advice of Italy's foreign ministry. The two had the press accreditation suspended by the Ukrainian authorities while they were returning from the Bakhmut front in early February. For weeks, they were unable to work, awaiting interrogation by the Ukrainian security service. Both journalists claim that Kiev's decision was unfounded.
Ukrainian authorities have never explained to us why our press accreditation was suspended. What we know is that both of us carried out independent reports in Ukraine and in the republics of Donetsk and Luhansk between 2014 and 2015. At least two other Italian journalists have received the same treatment. On our fixes chats, there were talks that we had been collaborating with the Russians, that we were spies. It would have been really dangerous to stay in Ukraine for us.
Some Italian media have reported that at least eight Italian journalists have been blacklisted by the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense over the past weeks. According to the two journalists, Ceresini and Bosco,
all of them had reported from the Donbas region in previous years.
C'è rimasta un'esperienza un po' di delusione.
We thought a solution could have been found during Italy's Prime Minister Meloni visit to Kiev last month. We were ready to discuss our situation with the Ukrainian authorities. It goes without saying that we are disappointed.
Andrea Ceresini is an expert on far-right terrorism in Italy's 70s. He has been freelancing for a number of authoritative Italian broadcasters and newspapers from many areas of crisis, including Egypt and Venezuela. Alfredo Bosco established himself for his photo reportage on Mexico's drug cartels and 2010's Haiti's cholera outbreak.
Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has yet to comment on the suspension of the two journalists' press accreditation by the Ukrainian authorities, nor has she ever expressed support for them. Rome has been a staunch supporter of Kyiv since the beginning of the war in Ukraine over a year ago. Max Civili, Rome.
Introducing a new role model by outlining the most important characteristics. The third model for women may be the answer to women's woes, and what better occasion to discuss this global issue than International Women's Day. The concept of the third model for women was presented initially on March 6, 2012, by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And now academics and researchers participating in an international congress held in Tehran have taken the opportunity to shed more light on this new concept.
In order to present this new role model and to explain its different dimensions, we must allow a scientific discourse to take place. Therefore, we must first theorize the two models that exist, namely the Western narrative of women and the Eastern viewpoint. Then we can create a platform for promoting the third model, which is the Muslim women.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution presented this concept about 10 years ago, and by holding this conference, we want to promote third model for women to the elite in order to design a comprehensive plan of action. We should start with articles, books and meetings, and then we can move forward.
According to the foreign participants of the conference, the issue of the status of women in today's world is a complicated one, and practical examples are necessary to understand the concept. One faculty member in particular raised an interesting point.
In Iran, women clearly play an important role in the society, and women are active in all different aspects of social life. Many of them are known worldwide. So I think that if we're looking for practical examples of this concept, all we need to do is look at the Iranian society.
In the East, traditionally women have been sidelined, and in the West they are mostly exploited for political and economic gains. But Islam presents a different viewpoint.
Iranian women and Iranian Muslim women in particular reflect the teachings of Islam and how Islam defines women. They are active members of the community. This is quite evident in the Iranian society.
Reflecting the true image of Iranian women while highlighting their achievements is a necessary step that needs to be taken.
Ayatollah Khamenei believes that in the Islamic school of thought, women play an exceptional role in the society, and therefore he presents a new and more realistic model. Very different from the Western capitalist and the Eastern sidelined and passive woman. The third model is the Iranian Muslim woman, an active member of the society who has opened a new chapter in history. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
A high-ranking Iranian delegation headed by Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus. The top official met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who welcomed Iran's participation in the upcoming quadripartite talks between Syria, Turkey, Iran, and Russia. Assad asserted that Syrians' interests are the basis for any steps or dialogue the government makes. Amir Abdullahian renewed Iran's support to Syria. He said Iran trusts Syria's stances and decisions and will support them during the quadripartite talks. He also welcomed the recent ease of tensions between Syria and Arab countries. The top official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad, followed by a joint press conference in which Amir Abdullahian underlined that dialogue is the only way to end the region's dilemmas.
will continue to support Syria during its hardships. Bilateral talks and dialogue in the region is the only solution for crisis. We will welcome the upcoming quadripartite meetings in Moscow with the aim of increasing cooperation and ending all crises.
He added that the recent Israeli aggression on Aleppo indicates the regime's barbaric attitude and reflects its concern over internal crises Israel is facing. Amir Abdullahian said it is time that all foreign troops illegally present in Syria to leave, calling on all sides to respect Syria's sovereignty. Miqdad, for his part, said coordination between both countries is at its highest levels, describing Iran's role during Syria's unrest as positive.
The role played by Iran in Astana talks in all stages of Syria's crisis was a positive one. That's why, from the beginning, we welcomed Iran's participation in the quadripartite talks. This role always proved Iran's respect of international legitimacy in efforts to end crisis.
Amir Abdullahian also visited earthquake-affected parts of Syria, as well as temporary shelter centers, expressing Iran's condolences to the Syrian people and promising his country will continue to send humanitarian aid to the needy. Iran's foreign minister is exerting diplomatic efforts to speed up the restoration of relations between Syria and Turkey. The ties between Syria and Iran continue to set an example of steadfast strategic cooperation in the region based on trust and mutual interests. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Tens of Palestinians took to the streets after prayer, expressing their support with the Palestinian prisoners and Israeli jails against the repressive measures and policies initiated by the far-right Israeli Minister of National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir. Thousands of Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli prisons continue for the 22nd day of collective disappearance measures in response to the ongoing repression campaign. Islamic Jihad movement has affirmed its support for the Palestinian prisoners' civil disobedience actions in the face of the Israeli fanatic measures, stressing that the prisoners will never be abandoned.
We declare in the Islamic Jihad that we stand with the Palestinian prisoners and support their civil disobedience actions. And even if the measures escalated to an open-ended hunger strike, we will support them and ready for all the possibilities. We will never abandon them.
On top of these measures is the approval of a draft bill that would authorize the execution of the Palestinian detainees that have performed anti-occupation operations. The campaign is expected to culminate on the first day of the upcoming holy fasting month of Ramadan, with a full-scale hunger strike bearing the banner of Freedom or Martyrdom. Palestinian prisoner's father expressed his concerns over the hunger strike step, calling for the international organizations to support the prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners' families live in stress over the lives of their sons and daughters in Israeli jails, as hunger strike is the most difficult thing a prisoner can endure, and it threatens their lives.
Palestinians chanted slogans against the far-right Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir and called for the immediate halt of the repressive measures.
Our prisoners' cause is a just one, and we support them in everything they take against the Israeli measures. We call on the world to support the Palestinian prisoners and put pressure on the Zionist occupation to stop passing the law and stop repressive measures against prisoners and detainees.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip stressed that Israel's hostile policies will never stop them from exercising their right to resist the regime and its settlers. Al Asif, Gaza.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible?
Oh.
Quran.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت القرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
A non-governmental group in the United States that closely monitors the violence of the police in the United States has reported that last year the U.S. police had a record of killing people, especially black people, as they killed an average of more than 3 per day. Every year in the United States, about 1,000 citizens are victims of police brutality and die from police shootings. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Officials said on Monday, 30th of January, 2 more Memphis police officers have been disciplined and 3 emergency responders fired in connection with the death of Tyre Nichols. That brings the total number of officers who have been disciplined to 7, including the 5 police officers who were fired and charged recently with second-degree murder and other offences in Nichols's beating and January 10 deaths. According to multiple reports, the Memphis police major, Karen Rudolph, said on Monday, 30th of January, police officer Preston Hemphill was relieved of his duty and put on what is known as administrative leave. Later on that day, it said another police officer has also been relieved of his duties, but without naming the person or specifying what role they played in the incident. Memphis Police Major Karen Rudolph stopped short of saying what role Hemphill had at the scene of Nichols's deadly beating or whether he would be charged with a crime in connection with the killing, as several other police officers have been. But Karen Rudolph said that the investigation into Nichols's death continues and more information will be shared as it is developed. In a statement, police said all 7 police officers have been relieved of their duties on 8th of January. Also on Monday, fire department officials announced the firing of the emergency medical technicians Robert Long and Michael Sandridge and Lieutenant Michelle Whitaker in connection with Tyre Nichols' death. The Memphis Fire Chief, Gina Sweet, said in a statement that her department had received a call from police to respond to a report of a person who had been pepper sprayed, and the workers arrived as Ty Nichols was handcuffed and leaning up against the squadron car. The statement said Long and Sandridge, based on the nature of the call and information police gave them, failed to conduct an adequate patient assessment of Ty Nichols. Michelle Whitaker and the driver remained in the vehicle. The statement said an investigation determined that all three had violated multiple policies and protocols. Officer Hemphill was the third police officer at the traffic stop that preceded the violent arrest, but was not at the scene where Ty Nichols was beaten. Lawyers for the Nichols family asked on Monday why the department had not disclosed disciplinary action against Officer Hemphill earlier and why he had not been fired or charged. News of the additional police officer's removal comes as calls for changes to American policing intensify after Ty Nichols' death. The chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, Stephen Horsford, said a group of 60 members of Congress had asked to meet with the president in the coming days to push for negotiations on much-needed national reforms to our justice system, specifically the actions and conduct of our law enforcement. The appeal to President Biden, who has called on Congress to pass police reforms, came as protests prompted by Nichols' killing continued in Memphis, Tennessee over the weekend. Ty Nichols, who was black, died on 10th of January, just 3 days after Memphis police officers beat him after a traffic stop. Ty Nichols' parents, who have been invited to attend President Biden's State of the Union speech on 7th of February, said the 29-year-old was driving home after photographing the sunset. Video footage released by Memphis officials last week showed police officers kicking and punching Ty Nichols and hitting him with a baton. CNN's website has also covered this story and tells us more. The attorney representing the Nichols family, the family of Ty Nichols, a 29-year-old black man killed by Memphis police recently, has called on Congress to use this tragic death to pass reform legislation to rein in the epidemic of police brutality in America. Ben Crump, the attorney representing the Nichols family, said, "Shame on us if we don't use this tragic death to finally get the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act passed." Ty Nichols' death had sparked protests across the United States and rekindled the debate about the need to change the culture of police violence in the country. Ben Crump said, "It is this culture that says it doesn't matter whether the police officers are black or Hispanic or white, that is somehow allowed for you to trample on the constitutional rights of certain citizens from certain ethnicities and from certain communities." Members of Congress said on Sunday, 29th of January, they need to revive their effort to pass substantial police reforms. The chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Dick Durbin, a Democrat of Illinois, acknowledged that while police officers purportedly risk their lives for Americans every day, some of the same officers are engaging in horrible conduct. He told ABC's This Week program, "What we saw on the streets of Memphis, Tennessee was just inhumane, horrible. I don't know what created this rage in these police officers that they would congratulate themselves for beating a man to death, but that is literally what happened." Dick Durbin said he would not rule out a federal investigation into the Memphis Police Department following the violent encounter with Ty Nichols. According to academics and advocates for police reform who track such deaths, nationwide police have killed roughly 3 people per day, consistently since 2020. Police reform talks, spurred by the death of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, collapsed in Congress in 2021, after lawmakers failed to strike a bipartisan deal. CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. More protests have erupted across the United States, including in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, against the killing of the young black man by the Memphis police, with protesters marching and blaming the U.S. government for the rising violence against the black community and saying the system is murdering us. Thousands of people have marched through the streets of Oakland, California, to protest police brutality and systemic racism against minorities and to demand justice for young black man Ty Nichols. The protest rally was organized by the Anti-Police Terror Project. Speakers at the rally included family members of residents who were killed by police. They strongly condemned the violence against people of color in America. Kat Brooks, executive director of the Anti-Police Terror Project, which organized the event in Oakland, California, said, "What happened to Ty Nichols is not an exception, it's the rule, and it happens every single day in this country. This is what American policing looks like." People from around San Francisco Bay Area joined in the protest to express their outrage at the U.S. police killing of blacks and other minorities. Brianna Vieira, who lives in San Jose, California, was quoted as saying, "Obviously, we're here to collectively grieve Ty Nichols' brutal murder and to stand in solidarity with the Memphis community." Police violence against African Americans and Asian Americans in the United States has assumed alarming proportions in recent years, creating fear and panic. In May of 2020, following the Minneapolis police killing of George Floyd, mass protests erupted in the United States against police brutality and systemic racism. Protests and demonstrations took place in many U.S. cities and spread to even beyond America's borders. The 46-year-old, George Floyd, was killed by a white police officer who was kneeling on his neck. Video recording of the killing showed the former killer cop, Derek Chauvin, pressing on George Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes as the victim begged for mercy. The video clip went viral, triggering mass protests throughout the United States and the wider world.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum, this is IRB English Radio and you're on to Youth Station. My name is Muhammad.
Oh, and my name is Muzaffar. Choo Choo Kachoo is the Youth Station for you. You're wishing you had said it now, aren't you?
Okay, so today we have something very beautiful to talk about, and that is a Jihad of Tabyeen or Jihad of Clarification.
Any soldier, before he goes into the battlefield, needs to have a basic understanding of how to use the weaponry at his disposal.
Exactly.
Right? My point here is everybody already has that initial knowledge to go into the battlefield, right? And it's actually in the battlefield itself that soldiers pick up the most experience and learn the most. Shahid Qasim Soleimani did not become Shahid Qasim Soleimani by sitting outside of the battlefield and being an objective observer. No, our leader himself, Imam Khamenei, he was one of those who we see in military uniform, and that's one of our reasons for why we have so much pride and love him so much, you know, because he was in the uniform, he was in the battlefield, he was amongst the people, he fought. And that's how he's now being able to identify that one of the biggest objectives and emergencies that we have in today's time is Jihad al-Tabiin, the Jihad of Clarification. If he wasn't in the battlefield, he wouldn't understand that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the most important issue right now that we, like the urgent issue that we mentioned, that we must use this approach of Jihad al-Tabiin against?
That's too much of a big question, man. We are literally, I'm sure you sensed it. We are being attacked from every angle. Every single angle. I can't think of an angle where we are safe. God forbid that because of these words and these sentiments, you know, God shows us, no, actually, you weren't being attacked from here either. Now you're being attacked because every time you say, nowadays, every time you say, oh, you know, it can't get any worse, it gets worse. People are struggling to hold on to even their most basic, most obvious ideologies. Like, what gender am I?
Oh my God.
You know, am I even human? Back in the day when I was younger, I remember youths used to have confusions about whether they exist, you know, and so they'd have these philosophical questions. Mm. Now it's like, do I identify as a male, female, or both? What do I identify as today? This is how, and the Quran says, وَلَيْسَ ذَكَرُكَ الْأُنْثَى. It's just a tiny little kind of phrase that Allah has thrown out there. It says, you know, the male is not like the female.
Now, clear cut, very clear.
Now, come on. If we had read this like 100 years back, we'd be like, Allah is just speaking, you know, a bit, it's just poetic, but it doesn't really have any meaning and it's not going to help us. Now, in today's world, we understand that every phrase of the Quran,
it's the miracle of the Quran,
it is not only relevant, but it increases in relevance. In today's time, this statement itself, the male is not like the female, can get you arrested, can make you lose your job, can make you lose your educational certificate. Even if you're a top psychologist, even if you're a professor in the best of universities, you will lose that certification because you've said such a statement.
For those living outside of Iran, and I think one of the most important points of Jihad Tabi'in, the struggle of clarification is this. You find, especially recently with the riots that we had, there wasn't a single country that didn't relay the news, negative news about Iran. Yeah. And I've had instances where some of my classmates,
including
my close friends, they were called by their parents and their family, like, come back soon, because any time now, they're going to eat you. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah.
So it was funny for us because we're in the field, we're looking at this, we know what's going on, and we know where it's going on, right? And we know who are doing this, because we've seen it in our own eyes. Right, but then those outside who haven't seen it just, you know, blindly accept the media how it's you know, portraying about Iran. I think for us, Jihad Tabi'in in these situations is actually closing our eyes to the media that's portraying, you know, falsehood, and trying to open up ways of sending news to people who are kind of victims of this media.
I wouldn't say it's closing our eyes to the media, because you have to keep your eyes open.
Yeah, well, when I mean close our eyes, I mean don't believe them, of course, right?
Yeah,
And make sure that those who are believing them, you bring up enough. Like, for example, what they do, one of the rules in media is repeat the falsehood as much as you can until they believe it's the truth, right? One of the arts of media is just repeating it. So one of the things that we have to consider as well is repeating.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I remember one of my family members, he was doing something that I won't mention here, but then my father's like, he's your age, why don't you tell him? Right? I was like, I told him. He's like, tell him back again. Tell him back again. 10 times, 20 times. If you say these things enough, a stone will become water.
Mm.
A stone will just disintegrate.
Yep.
It's very important repeating it. What about hijab? Like, in our society, unfortunately now, some people in the society in Iran, they've made this a trend to be as illegal as they can by removing their hijab, right? I think just repeating this to them, my sister, hijab is not a country thing. It's a Muslim thing. It's an Islamic thing. It's not for anybody else. It's for yourself. Repeating this really does the clarification itself.
There's a lot that needs to be done. And I think that everybody just needs to find their specific niche where they will be able to be most effective and act on that field. You know, if somebody's into sexual ethics, for example, if somebody's into hijab, for example, if somebody's into the economic situation, if somebody's into the system of Wilayat al-Faqih and other political systems, whatever it is, you know, whatever your field is, or the scientific advancements that they're making nowadays, all sorts of fields that do exist, and they're attacking us through those fields, they're attacking Islam through those fields, find a way to fight back in that specific field. And that's what we don't see happening.
Mm-hmm. With all the capability that you have, you must stand for that. And like you said, find your own niche and find out your own responsibility in that niche. Okay, let's take a break and we'll be back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
All right, we're back with the Youth Station. We're discussing about the struggle of clarification, Jihad of Tabiyyin, as mentioned by the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, or the leader of Ummah entirely. How do we know that we're doing Jihad of Tabiyyin correctly? Many a times what happens, like for example, in the ayah of Surah Kahf, it says, أَلَّذِينَ ضَلُّوا سَعْيَهُمْ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا وَيَحْسَبُونَ أَنَّهُمْ يُحْسَنُونَ صُنْعًا. Some people, they struggle their entire life thinking and calculating that they're doing the best and they're doing the good, right? How do we know that we don't fall into this trap? How do we know that while doing Jihad al Tabiyyin, we're not destroying the deen?
Mm. It's a really, really scary verse that you just recited there. Imagine you've spent your entire life, all of those energies that you've put into it, but it's actually been in the entirely wrong direction. It's like you're trying to get out of
a prison.
The
benefit of the enemy, essentially.
Hmm?
It's to the benefit of the enemy.
It's the it is, totally. So imagine you're in a prison and you've been digging and digging and digging at a secret tunnel. And then after 30 years, you find out that you've been digging in the wrong direction.
That's, exactly. You dig into some other cell.
Yeah, you dig into somebody else's cell. And then he cannibalizes you. How do we avoid that? I'd say the first thing is niyya, your intention, right? If a person's intention is on the right track, even if he's doing the wrong thing,
God turns that track.
Subhanallah, right?
Yeah.
Allah will take that a'mal of his. Let's take an extreme example here. Christian, for example, they're monks. They spend their entire lives in celibacy, eating in a very restricted manner.
Seclusion,
away from everything. If a person is doing that because they want to show off and I am holier than you,
then the
niyyah is completely wrong here. But if there's somebody who does that really with a good intention, a pure intention,
sincerely,
I want to serve God, right? You think? Are you telling me that that guy is going to go to hell? Of course
no,
not.
No, definitely.
Right? So coming back to us as Muslims, you need to make sure that you're not doing it for money. You're not doing it for fame. You're not doing it because you're angry and you hate other people unduly, not for the sake of the religion, but because of your own selfish reasons.
And so on.
Or stubbornness. Yeah, I mean, that happens when you see these debates going on, you're like, okay, this is just getting
I've said this before, I have to stand.
Yeah, I have to stand
with
it, right?
Yeah.
All of these things, once you really go back to the books, you analyze it and you have to be, you can only be the judge of that. You have to understand that yourself. Once a person does that, then they know, okay, Eliminate. Cross everything off your list. I'm not doing it for this. I'm not doing it for that. What is left? Yeah. If the only thing that's left on your page is God, then alhamdulillah, your niyyah is fine. Okay, but that's just niyyah. You can have the right niyyah and actually do damage to the cause.
Exactly. And right? I think one of the ways...
By the way, you're secure. Your worldly life and your hereafter, you are secure. But you might actually be doing damage to the cause.
Yeah, like those many Daeshi soldiers who went and joined Daesh, thinking their niyyah was probably or maybe, you know, clean and they were sincere, but then they were doing the wrong thing, right?
Yeah, I mean...
But I think one thing when it comes to jihad...
I just want to add there because, I don't know, I have a little bit of an issue with those kinds of examples because you hear them a lot, especially in our environments, right?
I was speaking hypothetically, but I'm because
hypothetically,
I'm sure.
Hypothetically,
a person joining a group that is...
If you actually look into those groups, they don't have that purity of intention.
Yeah.
They are the most hideous personalities that exist. They really are self-exultant, incredibly arrogant. And many of them could not even recite the Quran properly.
Yeah.
They had no interest in actually contemplating about the religion. They literally had been addicted to games like like Call of Duty. And
all they wanted was a gun in their hand.
They wanted a gun in their hand. Yeah. They wanted to go. And the British or American militaries didn't accept them for whatever reason, or this seemed more exciting, and they went. That's not... They would have a list full of things for which they were doing it. And,
exactly.
You know, God would probably be very, very right at the end of their list.
When it comes to knowing exactly on what side you are, I think one of the best way of the criterias of, you know, kind of getting this right is the analogy that one of the shuhada of the Iran-Iraq war mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Said that whenever, for example, consider you're in a night, in darkness of the night, which direction to aim at. Look at where the enemy is shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Look at where the enemy is bombarding. You'll know that that's your side.
See, that's a really good example, by the way. But that's the precisely the kind of thing which would prevent people from... Because, for example, in the West, we know that the enemies are pushing emphatically on LGBT.
Exactly.
And that's precisely where we don't want to go.
Oh, yeah, that is true as well.
Right?
If you zoom out a bit, you know that the enemy is trying to distract.
Yeah.
Distraction... Yeah. is what you should avoid.
Yeah.
Right? This is how I see it. Uh-huh. So even though LGBT is what they're trying to promote, or feminism is what they're trying to promote, and they want you to be distracted into this, go into this and keep discussing so that you forget about the more important matters, just know that they're trying to distract. They're attacking distraction.
Yeah. So I think the first thing, niya. Second thing, look at where the enemy is attacking you. I think that's a very good point. Third thing, focus on what you know. Like the wise old Ayatollah Bahjah told us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Focus on what you know. Act on what you know. Who doesn't know that Palestine is oppressed?
Oh.
Who doesn't know that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah? You know, he said it so with such emphasis that, look, why are people not tweeting and using social media to at least express their emphasis and support for Palestine? I mean, it's so obvious and clear.
Yeah.
Even though so many non-Muslims even understand this issue, right? So focus on what you know. Keep your niyyah pure.
Look at where the
enemy is attacking us. And the third thing is focus on what you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's all the time we have for the Youth Station. We leave you in the warm grace of God Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.